In the days since his dramatic release from the Taliban, the Pentagon, fellow soldiers, and Afghans have presented two vastly contradictory portraits of Bo Bergdahl. Deserter or good soldier?
The prisoner exchange that became a partisan issue. From WNYC in New York, this is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. Slender Man, an image born on a horror fan site, is said to have inspired at least two attacks. Slender Man's inventor surveys his monster.
Some people had joked in the thread that, oh, wouldn't it be funny if someone said, oh, these pictures look real, they must be real, but I don't think anyone really expected that to happen.
And turns out last weekend's headlining AI breakthrough is not all it's cracked up to be.
Right at the beginning of the press release, it actually says a supercomputer passed the Turing test. It's not a supercomputer at all. It's a chatbot.
Plus other stuff after this. WNYC in New York. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone.
I am glad that we got our guy back. However, I do not feel it is right that we subject ourselves to these acts of terrorism. I do agree with our guy being back, but however, I do not think we should subject ourselves.
Miss Louisiana, in her confusion, is nevertheless more consistent than many of the more practiced critics, now outraged that five Taliban commanders in Guantanamo have been swapped for U.S. POW Bo Bergdahl. The Pew Research Center has found that public reactions to the Bergdahl case are deeply partisan. Fully 71% of Republicans think that the prisoner exchange was the wrong thing to do, while just 16% say it was right. Democrats, by more than 2-1, 55% to 24, have a positive opinion of the deal. And why wouldn't you form an instant, uninformed opinion? After all, Jesus said, "By their fruits you will know them." Why not by their beards?
He says he was growing his beard because his son was in captivity. Well, your son's out now. Right. So if you really don't no longer want to look like a member of the Taliban, you don't have to look like a member of the Taliban. Are you out of razors?
Well, you know, Mr. Bergdahl's beard is not a tribute to ZZ Top. It's just sad. And that offended me, and it offended every soldier, I'm sure.
My job is to be honest and to analyze honestly. The man shows up at the White House looking like a Muslim. He speaks Pashto. He thanks Allah.
But if television has been potent in swaying the public's view, it's not just because of its fixation with apparently scary hair, but because reporters are obliged to quote elected officials who can collectively change their positions on a dime. In Bergdahl's case, that dime was dropped, according to the Sunlight Foundation's PolitiWhoops website, somewhere between June 2nd and June 4th, when mostly Republican politicians started deleting celebratory tweets about Bergdahl's release. Senator John McCain, who had earlier said that we should, quote, seriously consider a prisoner exchange, depending on the details, condemned this trade. And New Hampshire Senator Kelly Ayotte, who said this just before the trade.
We also keep Sergeant Bo Bergdahl in our thoughts and prayers, and will continue to do everything we can to find him and to bring him safely home.
On June 2nd, called for a hearing to investigate it. Now, let me pause for a moment and note that President Obama brought a lot of this upon himself. Lindsey Graham.
Well, we'll have to push them open later on. We're going to have a closed-door meeting where we'll learn almost nothing, as we usually do. We'll learn more from Fox News than we learn from this meeting.
Right. But in fact, the president didn't give Congress its mandated notice before taking action. That may be because in this Congress, there can be no compromise that enables action. Action on anything, according to the Pew Research Center, is at historic lows. But that's no excuse to evade the checks and balances of the system. While legislators hammered away at the president to do something about Bergdahl during his 5 years of imprisonment, the president could have conformed to the law, brought them this plan, and likely watched it fail. That's American politics in the third millennium. Meanwhile, Bergdahl's Benghazification is now well underway. Lindsey Graham again.
This is a very bad deal for America. And this is the same president who embraces never leaving anybody behind, but never picked up the phone during the night of the Benghazi attack to call for help in Libya and was virtually AWOL.
And so apparently is Bergdahl's swift boatification.
He's not a hero. He's a traitor. He's a deserter.
He's no crown jewel.
Yeah, yeah.
And he was a ballerina when he was a kid.
At least six soldiers may have died while searching for Bergdahl.
The first two clips are matters of opinion. Bergdahl's writings at the time he walked off base suggest that he was deeply disturbed. That last assertion is as yet an unfounded charge. According to recent reporting in the New York Times, it's probably untrue. But it doesn't really matter. This argument is not about those five Taliban commanders, the exchange of whom reportedly had been discussed for years to further the peace process. And it's not about a troubled man whose past history with the Coast Guard should have prevented his induction into the army and who spent much of the last 5 years locked in a cage. This is an argument about Obama and the Democrats. Bergdahl is, if you will, just a political beard.
You know, if I'd have been president, I would have gotten Bergdahl back for some second stringer like Abdul Rahim al-Nashiri and whatever's in my pocket. Looks like $1.75.
$1.75 and all.
No. That is still way too much. If I was president, I would have gotten Bergdahl back for an 8-gig iPhone 3 and a pack of gum.
House Majority Leader Eric Cantor's stunning defeat in a Virginia Republican primary to little-known David Brat has fed several broad media narratives. For instance, that it signals a resurgence of the very recently down-and-out Tea Party.
After a string of defeats this year, the Tea Party defeat of Eric Cantor last night is his biggest win yet. They didn't just give him a scare, they blew him out.
And that no incumbent is or shall ever be safe.
The people of Virginia delivered a fatal blow to the very heart of the Washington elite class, the establishment class, who brazenly thought their terms would never end no matter how bad things got.
And that it reveals Republican rage against immigration reform.
It used to be the debt, then it was health care, now it's immigration.
That interpretation is flat wrong.
Whit Ayers is the founder and president of North Star Opinion Research, which provides strategic advice to Republican candidates for office. He said that those conclusions are extrapolating way too much from way too little, especially on immigration.
Eric Cantor never voted on a comprehensive immigration reform package. He never put together a comprehensive immigration reform package. He never said anything about a comprehensive immigration reform package. On the other hand, Tuesday saw the victory of Lindsey Graham. South Carolina Senator Lindsey Graham promoted immigration reform in 2006 and 2007, and in 2008 defeated an opponent who ran against him on that issue by 2-1. He turned around in 2012 and 13 and authored, along with his colleagues, a comprehensive immigration reform plan. He was a member of the Gang of Eight that pushed it through the Senate, and he had six people running against him this year, largely on that issue. He defeated the second place candidate by 41 percentage points.
Oh, and by the way, national polling shows that what percentage of Republicans actually support some level of immigration reform?
70% of Republicans support an earned path to some form of legal status, and that has been a consistent number over several years.
So a political event happens, and I'm a reporter, and one of my responsibilities is to let my audience know what it all means. I examine the particulars and try to divine some sort of larger meaning, and you can't blame me for that. But we're talking about such a small sample size in a Republican primary in a single congressional district. What are my chances of drawing conclusions and actually having them be right?
Slim and none. The outcome of one primary race in one congressional district in one state says very little about other races in other states with different candidates and different environments. It would have been nice to see a story on Tuesday night that said any time a political outcome is this stunning and unexpected – the seeds of a defeat were laid some time before. It will take us a while to figure out exactly what those seeds are. Where immigration reform really was a dominant issue.
What was particularly striking about the definitiveness of the reporting on the Cantor story is that an equal amount of definitiveness was applied to a race a few days earlier when Mitch McConnell easily defeated a Tea Party favorite opponent, at which point the press declared the resurgence of the traditional GOP and the death of the Tea Party. I guess we can't take those conclusions any more seriously than the opposite ones being drawn in the Cantor loss.
We have some people who seem to have a compulsive desire to overinterpret a single event as a long-term trend. There is, in the Republican Party, a lot of energy behind the Tea Party cause. There is a lot of energy and desire in the Republican Party to be an effective governing party, and those tensions are still being worked out.
One final thing, the Kentucky race where Mitch McConnell prevailed over a Tea Party insurgent, and that was used to conclude that the Tea Party is on the skids. And then, in this case, in the Virginia race, Cantor's loss led to the narrative that the Tea Party is once again in ascendancy. David Bratt may have shared a lot of ideology with so-called Tea Party favorites, but he wasn't embraced or funded by any of the major Tea Party organizations. How careless have we been in just throwing around the term Tea Party without further definition?
Pretty careless. David Bratt rejected the Tea Party label the night he won, and major Tea Party groups hadn't even gone in to support him. It seems to be used as a sort of all-purpose label for any kind of outcome that seems surprising, where anyone that might conceivably be seen as a part of the Republican governing establishment loses.
Whit, thank you very much.
My pleasure, Bob.
Whit Ayers is founder and president of North Star Opinion Research.
Coming up, think that the Snowden affair has diminished the government's craving for secrecy? Think again.
This is On the Media.
On the Media is supported by LegalZoom. If you've been thinking about starting your own business, LegalZoom can help you do it. Learn more about DBAs, LLCs, incorporation, trademarks, and other ways to protect your business and assets at LegalZoom.com. LegalZoom provides self-help services and can connect you with an attorney, but they're not a law firm. Enter OTM in the referral box at checkout for a special discount for On the Media listeners.
This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. The Central Intelligence Agency joined Twitter last Friday. The CIA's first tweet was, "We can neither confirm nor deny that this is our first tweet." A little self-deprecating humor from those zany folks who brought us waterboarding, assassinations, and countless overthrown governments. The kooks. Naturally, what followed was joking about never mind following the CIA, is the CIA following you? To which the agency responded with, "Thank you for the Twitter welcome. We look forward to sharing great hashtag unclassified content with you." Or not. Back in April, the Office of the Director of National Intelligence's website quietly posted Intelligence Community Directive 119. It was a casually posted PDF file, but its implications for journalists covering intelligence activities could be devastating. Stephen Aftergood, a government secrecy watchdog at the Federation of American Scientists, says Intelligence Community Directive 119 essentially eradicates routine contact between intelligence officials and the press.
It basically says that unless you're a senior official of an intelligence agency, you are not supposed to engage in any kind of routine contact with a member of the media. You're not even supposed to discuss unclassified information. You're not supposed to say anything at all of substance without prior approval from your agency.
Yeah, it sets up a protocol which negates the very common practice of a reporter on a beat checking in with his or her sources routinely to run a story down or just to keep channels of communication open.
Exactly. I mean, I think it's correct to say that most national security reporters do not receive their stories all neatly tied up with a bow. Many very important stories begin with a hint or a rumor or a word of mouth that then gets chased down through conversation after conversation and finally develops into a coherent story. This directive will just throw a wrench into that whole process. It will become far more difficult to develop new sources or to really do reporting.
Now, I'm guessing that people listening to this conversation, or some of them, are saying to themselves, well, wait a second, we're talking about spies, and this stuff is supposed to be secret. It makes perfect sense that they shouldn't be blabbing to reporters routinely or otherwise.
You know, there has always been a prohibition against unauthorized disclosures of classified information. What makes this directive so disturbing is that it erases that distinction. It says you cannot talk about anything that is intelligence related. Some of the most important reporting in the lead up to the Iraq war disclosed that there were dissenting views within the intelligence community about the state of Iraq's nuclear weapons program. Were those aluminum tubes usable in a nuclear weapons program or not? Those kind of dissenting views will become much more difficult to locate and report on under this kind of blanket prohibition that the intelligence community has adopted.
Do you know what triggered this move by the Obama administration? Is it related to the Snowden leaks?
The Office of the Director of National Intelligence says that it predates Snowden, that it actually responds in part to an initiative in the Senate Intelligence Committee in 2012, but the prohibition even on unclassified information is spectacularly heavy-handed. I think it's ultimately going to backfire against the intelligence community itself.
Backfire how?
Well, you know, whether they realize it or not, I think the intelligence agencies benefit by being the object of independent reporting. You know, in the short term, they may suffer some embarrassment, but over time, they gather a degree of public confidence and a kind of credibility. People also get a comfort level that if there's something really going wrong, reporters are going to turn it up. This directive undermines that confidence. It says you're not going to know about it unless the intelligence community has approved it for public release because alternate channels of information have been shut down.
When we're talking about the intelligence community, there's a bit of a paradox. On the one hand, it is by definition operating behind a veil of secrecy. On the other hand, it's still a government entity answerable to the people. And till now, there has always been room, has there not, for kind of routine reporting on non-classified matters that helped us have some window into the operations of the intelligence world. Can you tell me what that routine reporting till now entailed and how much of it will just disappear?
You're absolutely right that the business of intelligence at its core is conducted in secret. On the other hand, every single intelligence agency generates public information and has a public profile. A lot of that information helps to inform public judgments about threats that we face and options that we have for meeting them. Reporters follow up on all kinds of leads, not only about the substance of national security policy, but the conduct of the agencies themselves. But what this new directive says is that the only news you should expect to receive in the future is authorized news. The dissenters, the internal critics, the whistleblowers, unless they receive permission in advance, are not supposed to talk to reporters. And if they do, it will be a security violation and a possible firing offense. So the whole ecosystem of national security reporting is going to be disrupted by this new directive.
Steve, thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Stephen Aftergood is director of the Project on Government Secrecy at the Federation of American Scientists.
Last weekend, the Sudanese government dropped nearly 40 bombs on its own civilians in the Nuba Mountains in the country's south. The previous week, it dropped more than 50. You probably haven't heard about it until just now. You probably haven't heard of Nuba either, or the war raging there since South Sudan separated in 2011. A local rebel army left over from the war remained in those mountains, so in an effort to weed them out, the Sudanese government has been waging a brutal bombing campaign on everyone in the region, creating a humanitarian crisis that has received virtually no media coverage, except from one outlet— Nuba Reports, a news website rich with on-the-ground video, background briefs, and a growing social reach. It was founded by an American, Ryan Boyette. Boyette moved to Sudan in 2003 to do aid work almost on a whim after he read an article about the Sudanese civil war and was stunned that he'd never heard of it. But in 2011, when the government started bombing Nuba, his aid group evacuated. Boyette stayed behind. He's now married to a Nuban woman and calls Sudan his home. He says that even amid the falling bombs, he knew he couldn't let this war go unreported.
Immediately, my mind thought of what brought me to Sudan in the first place, that one article. In the last war, no one heard about what was happening because there was no way for reporters to get in. I organized some friends of mine in Nuba. Another organization gave us very small point-and-shoot cameras. The guys took the cameras, they went out, they would get reports, bring them back.
I want to direct attention to the quality of the videos on your site. They're wonderful, and they're also geolocated, right?
Every report that our guys do, every interview they do, they also take a photo that is tagged with GPS coordinates through the camera. Sometimes we'll share stuff with international media, and they say, well, how do we verify this information you're giving us? As soon as we say these are GPS tagged photos, immediately international media are much more willing and able to use the information.
So you function as a website for the rest of the world and as a kind of news service for various media operations within Sudan.
That's right. We're trying to develop a new way for Sudanese to look at media. Most of the news that you see in Sudan, whether it's television or print or radio, is opinion. It's very hard to get information.
What about the problem of balance? Is the issue so essentially black and white, you know, innocent people are getting bombed, end of story? Or do you ever bump up against some ethical conundrum?
Yeah, that's always a difficult step for us because we can't approach the government. The government has bombed my house because of the work that we're doing. Some of our reporters have been threatened. I realize that it's a very hard balance, and we try to give as much of the other side as we can, but we're always very honest with the organizations and media that we are providing a perspective, and if media uses us as a source, then they have the ability to get the other side of the story.
How do you confront Africa empathy fatigue in the United States?
Yeah, there's a lot of Sudan fatigue. My response is organizations, governments have always looked at Sudan in ways of what could be fixed right now. Don't think about it in that way. I used to think about Sudan that way when I first got there. My first year in Sudan, I used to think, okay, what's the most I can do this year to make the most difference? Because maybe I'll go back to America. After my third year there, I knew that Sudan was going to be my home. After I made that decision, I thought about Sudan in a completely different way. I thought about how will my life help people that have been going through this situation for so many years. There's not necessarily huge initiatives that need to happen right away, but small steps.
And you think people are more open to small steps?
I think, especially here in America, we are more open to the quick response, what can fix the problem right now. And I think a lot of times when we do that, we might fix the surface problem, but under that, the issues are still boiling, and it's just going to break through that surface.
You seem to have been motivated from the beginning by a news story. And I wonder whether you think your stories are actually making a difference.
Yeah, exactly what you said is something I think about quite a bit. And the thing that allows us, I think, to have started this team is the Sudanese. It's the Sudanese reporters, it's the Sudanese editors that are taking the risk. They're the first one on the scenes. If a village is burned down and people are displaced, they go inside the caves. When they see people who have run to the caves with no food, they go to the refugee camps. They're the real heroes in this. And as they do that, that encourages me to work harder, to come to the U.S., have meetings, talk to NGOs, talk to policymakers, and reveal to them what is actually happening on the ground. I'm yet to see the results, so that's very hard. But the first step is getting the information out. Before, in the last war, that information was not there. Well, no one has that excuse this war. We have all the evidence with us that we're presenting to the world.
You said that you've yet to see any direct impact from your work.
Let me explain that a little bit. I think that our partnerships with some of these other organizations within Sudan, to me, that's the most important thing. Get people in Sudan to know what's happening in their own country, and they're the ones that can decide if changes need to be made or not. It's not going to happen tomorrow or even a year, maybe even 2 years away. This is something that would take a very long time.
And I understand you're building a network, you're informing the people, you're creating the beginnings of a structure that might ultimately create a government more responsive to the people. That said, you've also launched this website for the outside world. So do you want outsiders to come in with some guns and some money or some monitors? What would that mean?
I think as the Sudanese people know what's happening in their own country, if someone in Khartoum sees how someone in the Nuba Mountains is affected by the war and their economic situation, not being able to provide for their family, suddenly bridges are made between these different groups. Once people start making those bridges, then the international community can help dialogue between the different groups that traditionally have been divided. And through that, the Sudanese can make the decisions on their own on how to move forward. So to me, that would be success. That would have lasting change instead of American soldiers or stopping. I don't think that's the answer at all. So it's very difficult. But the thing that gives me hope is there are people that have been fighting their government for years, longer than I've been alive, and they're still fighting. There's even a song in my wife's language, in a Toro language, that says, "We're going to fight for peace. Look at my arms. They're strong from planting my ground and building my house. Look at my legs. They're strong from climbing mountains. Look at my eyes. I've seen everything that you could possibly see." And then the song ends by saying, "I will continue fighting until the end of my days, just so my next generation can have peace." They don't get tired.
Ryan, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ryan Boyette is the founder and director of Nuba Reports.
Coming up, tracing the source of a seductive internet meme, the mysterious and now headline-grabbing Slender Man.
This is On the Media. This is On the Media. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. At the end of last month, a gruesome assault occurred in Wisconsin. Here's a local news report from CBS.
Two 12-year-old girls from Waukesha, Wisconsin, are in a juvenile detention center tonight. They're charged with attempting to kill another 12-year-old girl who was stabbed Saturday 19 times.
The two girls stabbed their best friend almost to death in an attempt to win the attention of a fictional online horror meme called Slender Man. Elsewhere this week, a daughter brutally attacked her mother with a knife, another assault reportedly linked to Slender Man. The mother spoke anonymously to Cincinnati's NBC affiliate.
We found things that she had written, and she made reference to Slender Man. She even had created a world for Slender Man in Minecraft.
Waukesha's police chief Russell Jack sees no room for doubt.
Parents should not be allowing their children to have unrestricted or unmonitored internet usage.
Thus has Slender Man, a fiction created for horror enthusiasts on a hobbyist website, reignited the debate about the threat that the internet poses to children. But you don't need the internet to inspire the vulnerable or the disturbed to violence. All kinds of material from anywhere can captivate the troubled mind. Convicted murderer Charles Manson believed the Beatles' lyrics were about murder and race war. They weren't. As Slender Man suddenly breaks into the headlines, maybe it's instructive to recall just how unsinister was its creation. Back in January, before the tragedy in Waukesha, On the Media producer and TLDR co-host Alex Goldman reported on the phenomenon.
From the City of Angels off the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be, across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Next hour, Biblical Prophecy with Ken Hansen.
George Norrie hosts a late-night show called Coast to Coast that you might have already heard of. If not, all you need to know is that people call in to talk about the paranormal. Monsters. The famous ones, like aliens or the devil, and the more obscure ones like chupacabras and the shadow people. Norrie's heard about most of them. But on November 6th, 2009, people started calling in about a new kind of monster.
Have you ever heard of the Slender Man?
The Slender Man?
Yes.
No, I have not.
He's very thin, and he wears a black suit. He has very long limbs, and his arms stretch.
But he looks human.
Humanoid, I'd say.
Is he evil?
I'm not sure. He's known as wanting to kidnap children.
I heard the caller talk about Slender Man.
The Slender Man. Do you know anything about this thing?
He's kind of been a big buzz on the internet lately. There's these videos on YouTube. Apparently he's stalking the director of the videos.
There's somebody out there that is an immediate threat to both of us.
Marble Hornets is a YouTube series, now in its fifth year.
Probably watching us right now that you mention it.
It's sort of like a video diary. A college student making a short film starts seeing a Slenderman-like figure called the Operator skulking in the background of his shots, and it only gets creepier from there. It has since spawned numerous imitators.
What is that?
Right now, right now.
What is that?
Slenderman also stars in a couple of video games which are so scary that YouTube users delight in filming their own terrified reactions to them.
Whoa, whoa, oh my god, what the hell was that? Oh, run, 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 I don't like it. Get out of here, get out of here.
Slenderman is different in every appearance. Sometimes he has tentacles or a maniacal laugh. He can be anywhere between 6 and 15 feet tall. This kind of versioning naturally happens when the internet collectively invents something. But actually, the Slender Man isn't something the hive mind created. He's one guy's idea.
Hi, my name is Eric Knutson, also known as Victor Surge on the internet, and I'm the creator of Slender Man.
Like pretty much every story you hear about someone who's deeply into the macabre, he's about the sweetest person you'll ever meet.
I'm a 33-year-old male, married. I have a 20-month-old toddler. I'm actually looking to become a school teacher.
In June of 2009, Eric posted the first pictures of Slender Man in a thread called Create Paranormal Images on the website Something Awful.
When you created this character, you just figured it was going to be like a laugh between you and Something Awful and something that didn't sort of get beyond that particular thread.
Absolutely. I mean, some people had joked in the thread that, oh, wouldn't it be funny if some of these ended up on paranormal websites, or if someone, you know, said, oh, these pictures look real, they must be real, oh, they're ghosts or creatures or whatever. But I don't think anyone really expected that to happen.
The images were so powerful that soon, almost everyone in the thread was just posting images of the Slender Man. Eric's monster quickly outgrew the Something Awful forums and started to show up on the rest of the internet. But whatever the internet's imagination thinks Slender Man is, no matter how many times he's remixed or spliced with other legends, Eric believes that the Slender Man has an immutable and specific set of characteristics, and always has since the beginning.
The way I see the Slender Man is his body can morph. If he wants to look like just a tall, more conventional-looking guy, that's what he'll look like. But if you keep looking at it and keep digging and keep searching, it's going to start getting worse and worse for you. I like the concept of a monster, a creature that causes general unease and terror. Its methods are strange. Its motives are completely inscrutable. So what is it doing? Why is it here? Is it taking people?
Does it bother you at all that the internet seems to have honed in on this thing and wanted to take it apart and put it back together and make it its own thing?
You know, a little bit. It does a little bit. I feel like less of a creator and more of an administrator in a lot of respects. Or the manager. I feel like I'm Slender Man's manager, and that he's out there doing his thing, and I need to kind of just watch him and take care of him. I find it like being my one shot as a creator in my life, and I don't necessarily just want to give that up.
The problem for Eric is that the corpus of Slender Man material is now so rich that people don't believe Slender Man originated with him at all.
A lot of people say that, oh, look, Slender Man existed prior to June 10th, 2009. Here's this old German folklore, here are these old woodcuttings or these pictures or these stories. And interestingly enough, a lot of that stuff is just fiction that was created post-creation of Slender Man. It's kind of a double-edged sword, the fact that as an urban legend, you know, we seek to obscure its own past to make it seem more real, but that also makes it seem like it's something that's always been there.
So it's like fake historical references to this character that people assume are real and then assume that that means that it's just part of this public domain tradition?
It's basically like a Google-powered confirmation bias, you know. Certain people just don't want to believe that it's fiction because it's obviously much scarier that way, you know, if it's something that's real or could be real.
In January of 2010, Eric registered a copyright on the name Slenderman, which doesn't stop fans from making their own work. It just stops them from being able to make a profit on it without his blessing. Although it's worth saying that talking to him, you really don't get the sense that his desire for control is about money.
If there's going to be a commercial exploitation of the character, I just don't want to see something that's going to be lame. I just want something amazing to come of it.
You don't want him doing ads for pizza rolls or anything like that?
No, no pizza rolls. And I mean, I will do my best to make sure that doesn't happen. But of course, at this point, you know, I have some say.
Every time the Slender Man appears in a forged historical document or a faux documentary photo, he becomes realer and scarier. And Eric disappears just a little bit more.
But this is growing on the internet, so it should be easy to find, huh?
Yeah, it should. It'll be really easy to find. Just type in Slender Man.
Okay, we'll check that out. That could be a good story.
Yeah. Okay. Pretty interesting.
Slender Man.
Pretty creepy.
That is weird. Slender Man.
Alex Goldman is a producer for On the Media and co-host of TLDR. Slenderman's creator, Eric Knudsen, has issued a single statement to the media since the attack in Wisconsin earlier this month. Knudsen said, "I am deeply saddened by the tragedy in Wisconsin, and my heart goes out to the families of those affected by this terrible act."
This past weekend, the tech media were all abuzz about a milestone moment in the history of computing and artificial intelligence. For the first time ever, a computer program had passed the 65-year-old Turing test.
The computer program, it's called Eugene Goosman, has passed the iconic Turing test.
If you're worried about computers one day taking over Earth, you're not going to like this report because a computer has done something no computer has ever done before, fooling judges into thinking it was a real person.
In order to pass the Turing test, a computer must be mistaken for a human at least 30% of the time during a series of keyboard conversations with a live person. The University of Reading, which organized last Saturday's test, says that the Russian-made program Eugene Goosman convinced 33% of the judges that it was human. That the test took place on the 60th anniversary of Alan Turing's death only added to the poignancy of the achievement. What took away from the poignancy of the achievement was that, according to TechDirt's Mike Masnick, the whole thing was bogus, and everyone who reported on it should have known better.
The press release came out of University of Reading, and it was from a professor named Kevin Warwick, who's got a fairly long history of issuing these kinds of well-timed press releases that the press eats up. Right at the beginning of the press release, it actually says a supercomputer passed the Turing test. It's not a supercomputer at all. It's an application. It's a chat bot. If you say something to it, it says something back to you. It's not this brilliant breakthrough in artificial intelligence to make something that will have a conversation with you.
Another thing is, it wasn't the first time anything passed the Turing test, right?
It's just a few years ago, there was a chatbot called Cleverbot that was entered into a competition and fooled almost 60% of the judges, which is an even higher scoring than this one had.
Something that puzzled me is that the designers of this particular chatbot told the judges that it was a 13-year-old Ukrainian boy.
They did a social game. They played the judges by telling them that it was a 13-year-old boy from the Ukraine so that the judges had a certain expectation for what the person they were talking to would say so that when it did say some very odd things in the actual chats, they just sort of brushed it off as it must be, well, because he's not American or not British, and therefore maybe it really was this Ukrainian boy.
Now, we can say that this whole episode was a kind of Turing test for the media, right? Could they tell a real story from a fake one? And as you noted earlier, Professor Warwick is infamous for his claims to the press. It's apparently been going on for decades.
In the late 90s and early 2000s, Professor Warwick became fairly famous for calling himself the very first cyborg because he had implanted a computer chip in his arm. It's not clear that the computer chip ever did anything, but because he put it under his skin, suddenly he was the world's first cyborg. And the press ate it up because what a great story. A few years ago, there was another example. The first human to contract a computer virus. What a great story. Everyone's going to click on that and see what that's about because everyone knows about computer viruses. And the idea that they're somehow morphing into humans is so exciting. For a while, someone kept a website up called Warwick Watch, which just detailed all of his crazy claims in the press and how the press was falling for it. The person who kept it going eventually decided to stop it because they said that Warwick himself was kind of using it as a list of his own personal accolades. He looked on it favorably as opposed to what it was supposed to be doing, which was mocking his crazy claims.
So a lot of media outlets ate this up. ABC and CNN, you have NBC, you have The Guardian, you have The Washington Post. But you also have tech sites that you think would know better. Gizmodo and CNET and Computer World and Science Alert, all of which are echoing the claim that a supercomputer has passed the Turing test or it's an AI milestone and so on.
None of them questioning who set up the trial, how carefully was it set up, was it reviewed, who were the judges, all of the basic normal journalistic questions that you should ask when there's a sort of fantastical claim about a milestone achievement. Almost no one seemed to have done that.
Well, here's the thing. Reporters were being delivered a neatly packaged bit of fun on a weekend from a respected institute of higher learning. What's the harm?
When you're talking about reporting on an issue that could have major impact in terms of computing and technology and how we interact with machines in our daily lives, you would hope that reporters would want to get that story right. There was also a lot of talk about, oh, are the computers taking over or should we be afraid? And the answer was always no, because of course you shouldn't be afraid. This was, you know, this was a computer that acted like a 13-year-old boy barely. It was an easy story and it happened on a weekend, something sort of fun to roll with that was going to get a lot of attention no matter what. It's true of anything that is a major scientific breakthrough where you have reporters who don't necessarily have the expertise in the area, who are very willing to take extraordinary claims and run with them.
But then why did Computer World and Science Alert and Ars Technica and PC World and Yahoo Tech and so on report this wrong? Don't they have the expertise?
It's one of those things where what seems like a really sexy story is very tempting to just write it up and get it out. And the cost of getting it wrong doesn't seem that big, whereas the benefit to getting this story up and getting all the page views from it, where everyone says, oh, you know, what a great weekend story. I want to read about these crazy, brilliant robots who are taking over the world. That's a story that people like to get out there and make sure that they have their version of it.
So what makes Tech Dirt so great?
Not publishing on the weekend.
Mike, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Mike Masnick is the founder and the editor of Tech Dirt.
Odds are you've heard that theme music before. Odds are you've heard it many, many times. It belongs to Tetris, the world's most ubiquitous and probably most addictive video game. It's easy to play, impossible to win, and with more than 170 million copies sold on more than 50 gaming platforms, one of the great time wasters in human history. And this year, it turns 30. Alexei Pajitnov is the man who started The Shapes Falling, and when he spoke to us from Moscow on the occasion of the 25th anniversary, he told me what he was doing when he created Tetris.
In 1984, I was a researcher and programmer in the computer center in Academy of Science of Russia, of USSR. My field of research was artificial intelligence, but really my heart was in riddles, puzzles, all mathematical kind of diversions. I love it since I was a boy, and as soon as I got more or less powerful computer on my desk, I immediately started to put together some riddles and board games and all this stuff. And Tetris was just one of these amusements for myself, which I did for my spare time.
And when you finished the program and actually experimented with it at your desk, did you realize that you had come up with video pistachio nuts? You know, once you start, you can't stop?
Exactly. I wasn't an exception. What happened to me happened with everybody else afterwards. So I did have my prototype without any scoring, any decoration, any even leveling, just a piece on the screen, and I couldn't stop playing it even to finish program. At this moment, I realized that this must be a really good game.
All right. Now, the Soviet Union in 1984 was not a noted exporter of consumer technology. Au contraire, how did it come about that this actually did become a substantial export product for the USSR?
Well, that was very true. We didn't have any experience in selling or licensing any intellectual properties. The only way that software was distributed was just copying from friend to friend on floppy disks. Tetris was a pioneer in this area, so... Mm-hmm.
So you were an employee of the Soviet Academy of Sciences at the time. And when Tetris began taking off outside of the USSR through these licensing agreements, naturally, the state came to you and said, we're going to share the revenue. Congratulations, you're a rich man, right?
No, absolutely opposite. So when the license was close to happen, the question of my ownership comes up. And the situation in Russia was very unclear about that. So basically, I came to my authority and told them, please, if you could pay me, please do. If you can't, that's fine, but just help me to publish this game. It's pretty important for me. And basically, I grant my rights for 10 years, and they really helped me to do all this awful paperwork with licensing, negotiation, and so on. And after 10 years, the rights naturally came back to me. But that was already 95.
Now, a lot changed in those intervening 10 years, like the dissolution of your country.
Exactly.
Were you still, even after the fall of the Soviet Union, unable to get what was due you?
Yeah, that was a very unclear and hard moment because they pretend that I never had rights or something like that. So we had temporary agreement and we share some royalty without resolving this debate for a number of years. And finally, me and my partner bought out the rest of the rights, and since 2004, we are fine. We are completely controlling Tetris rights now.
I want to ask you about the game itself. Mm-hmm. Now, I have to go back to the 70s, actually, and I remember playing one of the early video games called Pong, which was developed by Atari. And when I think back to how ridiculous I was to be putting quarters into machines and video arcades to play to play that game, I feel like an idiot. But I don't feel like an idiot going back to my first experience more than two decades ago with Tetris. Why does this game have such legs?
Well, many people have different opinion about that, but I still like Pong, and I wouldn't mind to put a couple quarters to enjoy it. I don't see anything wrong with it, by the way. But as far as Tetris is concerned, the game is very simple, and it has very natural user interface. It has some kind of creative style. In most of the game, you just shoot and destroy it. In Tetris, you try to build something, to put the order in this chaos of random pieces. And probably that's what makes you feel a little bit better about what you're doing with your quarters.
Let me ask you one last thing. Tetris, how good are you at that game?
Not very good. You know, first of all, I'm 54 already, and none of the people of that age could even compare with 14, 15, 16-year-old guys. I'm a little bit above average. I could reach level 12 time to time. I'm not absolutely bad, but nothing exceptional.
Congratulations on your anniversary.
Thank you very much.
Alexey Pajitnov is the designer of Tetris, which celebrates its 30th anniversary.
I know you're going to dig this.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was produced by Alex Goldman, PJ Vogt, Sara Abdurkhman, Chris Neary, Laura Mayer, and Kimmy Regler. We had more help from Andrew Chug. And our show was edited by Brooke. Our technical director is Jennifer Munson. Our engineer this week was Leslie Sisson.
Katya Rogers is our executive producer. Jim Schachter is WNYC's vice president for news. On the Media is produced by WNYC and distributed by NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for On the Media comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the Jane Marcher Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.